if I ever want to elicit a very angry glare from a rep, all I have to do is mention sending a product of theirs out to a third-party repair company. And, of course, they're always going to give me this really, you know, horrible story about some product that was, you know, MacGyvered back together.
In the midst of constant commotion in the healthcare industry, one unified voice rises above the rest, a beacon bent on banishing biofilm. They are sterile processing professionals who clean and sterilize their way to improved outcomes, and their patient safety victories often go unseen. This is Beyond Clean, the central nexus for the people, processes, and products that are pushing the sterile processing industry forward. Join us every week as we give voice to that global force, fighting dirty all around the world. It's time to go beyond clean.
This week on Beyond Clean, we speak with David Ambari. David is the Chief Executive Officer of Mobile Instrument Service and Repair, a national provider of repair and maintenance services for reusable surgical equipment. David brings a diverse background in industries outside healthcare to mobile. He blends his background in finance, technology, and operations to bring innovative solutions to enable providers to maximize their investment in surgical equipment. Recently, David has been a vocal advocate for the independent medical service industry, including multiple speaking engagements as well as presenting at the FDA's workshop on the issue. He serves as chairman of the Association of Medical Device Service Organizations, which is a trade association advocating for the right to repair and for strong quality systems for the servicing industry. Though David did not grow up in healthcare, he brings a practical business-focused perspective to the industry's challenges. So Mike, Hank, I'm definitely, you know, I'm in the repair world, so this is a conversation I've been excited to have for a while on this show, and looking forward to David giving some insight to the listeners.
Surgical instrument repair question is such a vital part of everything that we do as sterile processing leaders. Obviously, these instruments are our babies, and we don't like to give our babies to strangers, so it's important to know who these folks are out there in the industry who are touching them. And then also, as we get into the second segment, what the challenges are legislatively out there to how that industry is managed. So I can't wait to get to talk to David today.
Yeah, and I'm really interested in learning more about what's going on there on that legislative side that you mentioned, Hank, because there just seems like there's so much going on, but it has the potential to really affect our industry in an incredible way. And that's what I'm really looking forward to hearing David's insights on.
HealthMark has intelligent solutions for your cleaning verification program, including products to measure water temperature, water quality, cleaning efficacy, and to directly test for residual soil left on instruments. Find your tools for cleaning verification at hmark.com. There you will learn about our TOSI and SonoCheck that test the performance of mechanical washers as recommended in sterilization standards guidelines. Other products like CartWash Check test for mechanical efficiency and target temperature. The ProCheck 2 can detect residual protein to a very low level. Go to hmark.com today for all of your cleaning verification testing needs. It's 2023 and there's big news for IST. A closed warning letter, a new product launch, and a 10-year anniversary. OneTray IST has a lot to celebrate this year. OneTray's 2006 cleared 48-hour storage claim was acknowledged by the FDA, and the company is pushing forward, offering the total solution for reprocessing. OneTray maximizes reprocessing time. EasyTrax adds flexibility with instrument organization, and their upcoming product, OneCart, a sealed case cart with a smaller footprint and a perfect option for off-site sterilization, completes the total solution. Experience a year of efficiency with OneTray. For more information on the closure of the warning letter, visit OneTray.com/FDA warning letter. That's OneTray.com/FDA warning letter. Otherwise, you can reach out to the company by calling 937-619-0138 or visit OneTray.com/contact.
You're listening to Beyond Clean, the global voice of sterile processing.
Joining us now is David Ambari, Chief Executive Officer at Mobile Instrument Service and Repair, Inc. David, thank you for coming on the show. This is actually a topic I'm very interested in talking to you about because it's near and dear to my heart being in the industry myself. But this whole concept of third-party surgical instrument repair, essentially versus the original manufacturer and some of the things that are going on in the industry today that I think has a chance to really impact the future. So welcome to the show. We're really looking forward to talking to you.
Great to be here.
I think the first thing we want to do is maybe set the context. I'm sure many people that are listening to the show are very familiar with instrument repair. It's a necessary part of everybody's plan to have safe surgical instrumentation going into the OR. But maybe you could talk a little bit about mobile vans versus in-house labs and repair labs and the different options that are in the industry today.
Sure. What's most important in surgical equipment repair is really introducing that concept of preventative maintenance and providing ease of access to surgical equipment repair specialists for sterile processing professionals. There's a number of different ways that we can accomplish that goal of accessibility. And the one that really was the foundation for our company when it began was the concept of putting equipment repair technologies in the back of a truck and literally being able to drive it to our customer location and performing the repair and maintenance services directly there. The advantage that brought was that historically, surgical instruments were shipped back to manufacturers for repairs, which meant longer turn times, and it also meant increased inventory. By doing it on location, we could do it quickly, we could do it efficiently, and do it in a way that was very cost effective for the asset owner. Over time, we also got to the point where the types of repairs became sophisticated enough that we couldn't just do them in the back of a truck. They required more of a clean room type of environment, or they involved technologies like laser welders and powder coaters that simply couldn't be mobilized effectively. So that's really where we evolved into having a national repair depot model where our representatives that worked from the back of the trucks locally at the hospital could ship the instruments into a national depot to have the more advanced repairs performed. Over time, a hybrid model evolved, which was where a hospital would offer us space within their four walls, if you will, and we would establish a repair center in there that was somewhere in between those two different models, meaning we could do more than what we could do in a truck because we had a fixed location and we had more space to work with, but yet we still couldn't put $50,000 and $60,000 laser welding equipment in each one of those facilities. So there was still a need for a national repair depot, but it did allow us to achieve an even higher repair rate on location. So from our origins doing mobile work, it really spurred the national repair center. And then we found and settled at this middle point option that's also available called the in-house repair center within a healthcare facility.
So, David, by definition, a third party is not done by the original equipment manufacturer. And so some of the questions or perhaps concerns that come up within the industry is, then what kind of parts is this third party group using to repair a piece of equipment that they did not manufacture? And I know that is a source of a lot of debate today, and even getting into the second segment that we're going to talk about, the larger legislative debate. But can you speak to just broadly how these third-party companies are sourcing their parts and just what that looks like on the ground floor?
There's really four fundamental sources I think you have to look at for parts, and it's probably true for any reputable independent repair organization across various equipment types or modalities. The first one is, in some cases, we're actually able to purchase parts directly from original equipment manufacturers. They've elected to make those parts available to independent repair companies, and as a result, we can use an OEM part on those devices. In some cases, those might be parts that we buy that they don't even, you know, they sell them to a distributor and we might purchase them from the distributor and the OEM really doesn't know where the parts are going, but frankly, they don't care. They've elected to make them available on the open market and we purchase them in that same way. You know, I'd say the second way that we do it is we're able to locate the manufacturer of the original part that the manufacturer had make it. So said another way, if we're looking for a particular spring, we find the spring manufacturer that made it for the manufacturer, and we contract to buy a lot of them from them that are equivalent. I'd say the third approach to it is there is a very robust third-party market for parts for surgical equipment, meaning there are companies that specialize in basically reverse engineering the parts that the manufacturer used, both from a functional perspective, but also from a biocompatibility perspective to ensure that sterility can be accomplished. And they market those parts to a number of independent service organizations publicly. And then I'd say the final or fourth methodology that you'd find for parts availability is that many of the independent service companies actually have manufacturing facilities of their own or fabrication facilities of their own where we can make parts that are either hard to find or that we can't purchase economically. The real key to parts availability for any independent organization is, first, a really solid re-engineering process that allows us to take very, very technical takeoffs of that part to ensure that we're going to get something that's exactly functionally, substantially equivalent to a manufacturer's part. And again, the second piece is making sure that the material is equivalent. So whether it's a steel, a plastic, a resin, we have to do chemical analysis on those to ensure that the composition of what we're going to be putting in a device is equivalent to what a manufacturer would have put in that device. And that achieves the biocompatibility and the sterility assurance that's every bit as important as the mechanical function of the instrument. So parts are part and parcel, for lack of a better term, to our business. You know, it's really labor, parts, and tooling that allow us to accomplish those repairs, and an enormous amount of energy gets invested into parts sourcing and parts quality assurance throughout the industry.
David, along those same lines, what kind of training, competency, you know, quality assurance monitoring do the technicians who are actually doing the repairs receive?
So the technicians who perform repairs throughout the industry, for the most part, are apprenticeship-based trained by the repair companies, meaning the company has developed a training protocol based on the modality of equipment, based on work processes that have been defined over time and proven to achieve a repair that restores equipment to its original operating condition. So with repetitive practice, those individuals working under the stewardship of a master craftsman or a master technician can learn those skills directly, both from a technical standpoint and also sort of the artistic component of it, which is, you know, really knowing what pressure to apply when you're sharpening a scissor. You know, there's not a robot that's going to tell you how to do that. It's knowing that over time and getting a feel for it. So the critical component, I think, for anyone is to realize, look, there's a standardized set of work processes that sit behind these technicians. That's what forms the basis for the training. And for the most part, we all use an apprenticeship approach, which says we're going to train people to become proficient in the repair of a particular device or item. And once they've proven that skill and proven it repeatedly, then and only then are they allowed to work independently on something like that. Depending on the modality of equipment and the breadth of equipment that they're asked to work on, that process can take as little as 6 months for working on one particular type of equipment, or to really become proficient working on surgical trays that contain, you know, literally hundreds, if not thousands, of different instrument patterns. You know, you could be looking at upwards of 2 years before someone really reaches the point where they're a journeyman, and upwards of 5 years before they're a true master craftsman.
Yeah, it's definitely a niche industry, the technicians themselves. It's not like you can just go pick them up out of any old school or trade school either. There's definitely a lot of mentorship that's involved in that. There's no doubt. One of the things I wanted to ask you about too is just as far as consumers go, this industry, because it's a service industry, is one that the representation that you have for your organization just goes such a long way. You know, you can have a great model as a business, but if you're not implementing it out in the field in a certain market, you've got to go and support that market and build it back up and make sure that those things are happening. And when I say those things, I mean the value adds. You know, so this industry is, the customers are really looking for, all right, that's great. You've developed the preventive maintenance model and you've done a nice job of maybe bringing some cost savings, but they're looking for everybody to bring more to the table. So maybe talk about the value adds that can be brought to, you know, the hospitals and the SPD departments every day that can really help them get more out of their program and really help them achieve that surgeon satisfaction, that patient safety, and that cost savings in a perfect marriage.
As you pointed out, you know, so much of this industry is really predicated on service, right? I mean, you know, having a quality repair is the baseline expectation. So service really is what distinguishes a company in our space. And obviously, we are big believers in that because we've got it in our name. So from our perspective, service not only means the technician and their ability to complete the repairs, but it also means what additional value can they bring to the sterile processing professional, the OR theater, supply chain, you know, clinical engineering that goes beyond just effecting a repair. And we think a lot of that starts simply by understanding the rhythm of an individual facility's operating room and how things are reprocessed, time frames, days of the week, personalities, all those kinds of things to really engage with a preventative maintenance program that connects directly to the facility's requirements. We do things that go, you know, as a company that go as far as literally taking inventory and usage to be able to develop very, very complete preventative maintenance schedules that are unique to the type of tray and unique to its usage patterns so that we can make sure that the instruments are always ready for the OR. When you go past the core preventative maintenance services, the types of value adds that are most common in the industry probably would be educational programming, you know, ranging from CE credits towards ISHM or CBSPD certifications, or in the case of the OR, AORN certifications. Most of the companies offer programs in that regard. I know one of the things that we have implemented as a company in the past year is we had enough customers asking us to help their technicians achieve their CRCST certifications, which is the ISHM designation for central sterile technicians, that we developed an online learning program that guides people through that process over the course of about 10 individual one-hour episodes with both PowerPoint, video guidance, and then quizzes that are scored by our educator directly. Additional value adds that are common in the industry, support for instrument testing systems. So how can you ensure scissors work correctly or electrosurgical equipment works correctly? Those types of things that help deliver value directly to the sterile processing professional and to the operation as well. Increasingly, advisory services have also become part of the equation, meaning how can we come in, take a look at a sterile processing operation, including the OR, and help recommend ways that instruments can be cared for, handled, and moved around more effectively so that we reduce the propensity for damage. So, you know, value adds run the spectrum. And I think what you've got to really look at is how well do they connect with the core mission of what that surgical equipment repair company is trying to do for your hospital or your healthcare facility.
So, David, this segment was a general overview of third-party instrument repair, and it wouldn't be right to close the segment without talking about a few of the challenges existing in the industry, apart from the right to repair that we're going to get to in the next segment. How would you describe, or what would you list as some of the primary challenges facing the guys like you out there in the industry?
Obviously, as we talk in the second segment, the right to repair is something that I think everyone in this industry needs to care about. But challenges that we face independent of that, probably the single biggest challenge, I think, if my competitors were right here with me doing a roundtable, I think the number one thing that we would talk about is trying to dispel the notion that only manufacturers can repair their equipment. Opening people's mind up to the idea that it's not just the manufacturer who can complete a quality repair, and there's a more cost-effective way to do it that also brings much greater value to the healthcare organization, is probably the single biggest challenge most of us face. I'll tell you the second biggest challenge I think that's out there is with the consolidation that's taken place in this industry. Like everything else in healthcare, we're not immune to gravity. And with the flight to scale, whether it's a hospital or whether it's a drug company, everyone's getting thinking that bigger is better. And with that bigger is better mentality, one of the biggest challenges I think we all face these days is with really finding the right talent to put out in the field. You know, we're fortunate in our company in that our turnover is next to nil. And with, you know, an average of about 12 years of experience for our technicians, our biggest challenge in growth is finding people that we can build in their image, those 12-year experienced people. And, you know, finding sterile processing technicians, OR, surgical techs, people that come from a precision machining background, even watchmakers, those are the kind of people that generally are going to succeed. And finding that pipeline of personnel is really critical. So I'd say those are two of the biggest challenges that I think apply across the industry and certainly apply within my business.
Being able to work on micro instruments, you mentioned, you know, watchmakers, but even jewelry makers are a good one. You have to look for sort of a creative skill set that might be transferable because you don't necessarily know what kind of ability they'll have to be able to do the repairs. So, David, that's a great way to set the table, but that third party right to repair conversation is going to be an engaging one, and I can't wait to get into it in the second half of the show. We'll be right back with David Ambari. We're back with David Ambari, Chief Executive Officer at Mobile Instrument Service and Repair, Inc. And this is really the meat and potatoes, I guess, of this interview, David, which is diving into this background and details on the debate on the right to repair. So why don't we just get right into it? Talk about the main drivers, the why this is such a big time debate, and maybe the logistics of the arguments on either side.
Yeah, so topic that's near and dear to my heart for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is this has direct impact on the industry. It has direct effect on the cost of healthcare in this country. And I guess the biggest arguments that we've heard as we've gone through this process with the FDA and industry, the biggest arguments that we've heard that argue in favor of regulation really are all about safety and efficacy of devices, right? So does it work the way it's supposed to? And can we rely on the results? Because remember, this applies to everything from ultrasound to imaging equipment to a pair of supercut scissors. So safety and efficacy is really the number one factor. The OEMs have always made the argument that because they're held to FDA standards for their repair operations, that the third party or independent repair organizations aren't held to the same standard. So the OEMs have said it's just not a fair application of the existing rules across the industry. And when they say when they talk about it, not a fair application of the rules, it's not just independent service organizations. It's clinical engineering. It's biomed firms. So anyone that's involved in the repair of a reusable medical device, basically they should be subjected to the same rules as the OEMs, is what the OEMs would argue. Another big factor is that there is a lack of clarity on the life cycle of a device, meaning if a device has been repaired by the manufacturer a couple of times, by a third party a couple of times, how do we have a good, clear record of the life cycle of that device? And how can the OEM know that if a third party consistently replaces the same part, that part might be defective and might be a defect in all of their products that are out there? So having clarity around the life cycle of the device and what's been done to it, I think is a good argument in favor of regulation. The final argument that's come up a great deal with the Food and Drug Administration has been, how can we be assured that adverse events that take place that affect the patient, how can we be sure that those are being reported? And, you know, that one's a very controversial topic, not just because it involves patient safety and patient care, but because the real requirement for reporting any adverse event related to a reusable medical device falls on the user facility. They are required to report that. The manufacturer or servicing organization would also be required to report it if they're subject to FDA regulation. So making sure that those adverse events get reported is critical. So those are the four main arguments that you hear in favor of regulation. The biggest reasons you hear against regulation are, First off, there's no real evidence that there's a problem. You know, the only reliable study was conducted by ECRI, which is a not-for-profit organization that gathers and processes data from healthcare facilities on a wide range of topics. But the only reliable data that, study that's been done indicated that about 96 adverse events that affected a patient out of 2.1 million reports over a decade were related to servicing activities. That's 0.005% of all those reports. And there's, and that's really not something that you're going to move the needle much on, is the argument. Secondly, the argument against regulation is that the rules were really built for manufacturers. So if you look at everything that's required of a manufacturer, roughly one in six of those rules would apply to a servicing organization. And even then, it's very difficult to interpret it. I think the third big argument is that there's already a regulatory regime in place to ensure that reusable medical devices are effective in hospitals. And it's called everything from the Joint Commission to the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services and state health authorities that, that routinely look at maintenance programs within hospitals as a part of their survey process. Obviously, the consequences of regulation could involve a loss of competition, a loss of access to cost-effective preventative maintenance. And, you know, we talked about value adds in the first segment. You really, those value adds are primarily driven by and delivered by third-party organizations and not by manufacturers. And I think most healthcare folks would say those are really important to have. So those are sort of some of the arguments against it.
Yeah, David, I know that if I ever want to elicit a very angry glare from a rep, all I have to do is mention sending a product of theirs out to a third-party repair company. And of course, they're always going to give me this really, you know, horrible story about some product that was, you know, MacGyvered back together and those sorts of things. I was wondering if there are just some common misconceptions that you can kind of help clear up for us to be able to respond to those reps whenever they give us these, you know, phantom horror stories about something really awful that happened to this one customer this one time kind of thing.
Probably the first thing I'm always suspect of is I like to buy on value and I like to buy on strengths. And anytime I'm being fed fear and uncertainty and doubt by anyone, it instantly raises my radar to say, how do I know I'm being told the truth? I think the critical questions that you've got to ask of any service organization is to really understand their quality management system, understand how they achieve quality. And frankly, I think the best thing you can do is trial. There's no better way to experience quality than to give an independent company a repair that historically you've handed off to an OEM and let them prove to you that they can get the repair to the same standard as what you're used to from a manufacturer. But there's really no secret sauce to that. I will tell you that pictures of poor repairs that many manufacturers have amassed over the years, you know, I've got a file cabinet in my office, and I'll bet most of my competitors do as well, of poor repairs that were completed by other third-party companies and by manufacturers alike. There's no immunity from doing a bad repair if you don't have the right incentive system and the right quality system in place in your organization. And I think only time can really prove that to you. And using some common sense on checking the quality of repairs before you put things back into circulation, especially when you're making a vendor change, is just a natural outcome. I wish there were an easy way to litmus test some of those claims by manufacturers, but that blade does cut both directions.
So, David, I'd like you to tell us about the third-party repair advocacy group. You know, who's leading the charge, the mission, the purpose, sort of the next steps there.
Back in, I guess it was late 2016, the FDA conducted a series of public workshops. And basically, as a part of those workshops, they invited various industry groups or industry participants to come in and provide their perspective on the potential for oversight by the FDA on independent service organizations. What was interesting about that process was that it wasn't individual companies that were being chosen to testify, if you will, or provide input to the FDA. It was trade associations. It was large aggregated groups, primarily of manufacturers, that were speaking to the agency. I happened to have been chosen to be one of the people to deliver our arguments on behalf of the independent service world, but I was one company. And I quickly realized I was one company up against multi-billion dollar companies whose names will remain nameless, but who are all the big imaging players and others. And very quickly realized, wow, this is a whole different kind of battlefront. And one of the things we quickly realized as I talked with some of my competitors and some of my peers in the industry was that we really needed a voice that was independent of our own commercial interests to get these points across to both the FDA and to the industry as a whole and to the healthcare organizations that we all serve. And so with that, we formed the Association for Medical Device Servicing Organizations, and that we call it AMDSO affectionately. It's AMDSO.org. That's AMDSO.org. And the trade group was really formed to be an advocate for proper, responsible, and cost-effective medical device servicing. You'll notice the organization did not exclude manufacturers from its membership. The only thing that they asked of manufacturers is that it include manufacturers who service their devices and other people's devices. They need to be a multi-device service organization or multi-vendor. The organization wasn't dedicated to advancing independent service organizations. It was dedicated towards advancing quality, cost-effective, high service level repairs for reusable medical devices. And with that trade group, we've really been able to get a lot more traction and a lot more credibility with the FDA, with Congress, and a variety of other entities to get the message across that the OEMs don't have a monopoly on performing a quality repair.
Something that has stuck out to me in just following this debate over the last couple of years has been the widespread ignorance, maybe, or misconception, confusion, if you will, on the side of the media and how they're reporting about these challenges. And I know you were quoted actually in an article from the Detroit News back in 2016 and explaining the background to the issues and the questions. The reporter wrote, "Unregulated by either the state or federal government, medical device maintenance has quietly grown into a $50 billion industry." And then this is a quote that I love. "Vans staffed by repair technicians circle hospitals waiting for the equipment to break. Tools and pumps are rebuilt, sometimes with different parts to extend their lifespans, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera." Well, as an industry insider, I'm reading this thinking, okay, so this lady obviously does not have a clue about what's going on with this, and yet that's the type of information that's going out not only to the public, you know, but also probably getting into the hands of some of these hospital decision makers as well. Is your advocacy group also going to focus on combating that public ignorance, or are you more just legislative focus?
I would say there is absolutely a legislative focus. There's absolutely a hospital or healthcare provider focus as well in, you know, advocating for the industry as a whole and reminding many of those folks the value that comes from having independent service organizations in the marketplace, right? It's not just that the repair can be completed at a lower cost with the same quality. It's also having someone independent of the repair versus replace decision, you know, having an alternative to just buying another widget from the same old manufacturer so that you can really hold your capital costs down if you decide to hold your capital costs down. Extending the useful life of that equipment through preventative maintenance. There's a lot of value points there that should really incredibly matter to healthcare supply chain and healthcare business people. And certainly the organization is engaged in outreach to those groups. But let's face it, there's thousands of hospitals in the United States and surgery centers, and it's very difficult to reach them through any reasonable medium. So you'll find that through organizations like the Association of Hospital Materials Managers, we've reached out there. We've got outreach there. We've got outreach through ISHM. We've got outreach in a variety of different areas to try and reach those business level hospital healthcare decision makers. In terms of the public, it becomes a very thorny and delicate topic. The public simply, this is a horrible thing to say out loud, but the public simply does not understand the regulatory regime that exists on top of hospitals today. All the public understands is I pay too much for my health care and it's not as good as I think it should be. And to them, any indication of any chink in the armor, if you will, in how a health care facility delivers its care is always going to be considered a negative. We've made the conscious decision that in terms of consumer level outreach, there's other ways for that to be achieved. And we think that's through hospital trade associations. We think that's let's let the healthcare providers speak on this topic. It's not just the Herculean task of reaching the consumer. It's also the recognition that you've got to have a credible source for the consumer to hear that from.
David, can you fill us in on the current status of the legislative efforts then with your group?
So during mid-2016, Congress passed an act that essentially funds the Food and Drug Administration's approval process for new medical devices and drugs. It's called the Medical Device Users Fee Act, and it's required that Congress reauthorize that funding legislation every several years. At the last minute, the Subcommittee on Health actually inserted at the end of that act, which is called MDUFA for short, they attached to it a requirement that the FDA produce a report back to Congress that would address the issue of independent service of reusable medical devices. So that report is due back mid-year this year. And right now, the FDA is in sort of an information gathering stage where they are trying to understand both manufacturers' perspectives as well as independent service organization perspectives on the issue. And in theory, you know, are expected to make some form of a recommendation back to the Subcommittee on Health to say what, if anything, should be done to allow the FDA to oversee this industry. In the meantime, several industry groups have attempted to answer the question for the FDA. Among them is the Medical Imaging Technology Alliance, which is called MITA for short. They have attempted to draft a device servicing rule or device servicing policy for medical imaging devices. That went to a vote before their group in December and was rejected. It wasn't rejected because it was a bad idea. It was rejected because it was too specific to medical imaging and it really didn't do enough to promote cooperation between independent service organizations and manufacturers. So there's been a number of false starts, if you will, in trying to help the agency, the FDA, move this initiative along. But as it stands right now, the industry is really awaiting the FDA's report in mid-2018 back to Congress. And then it's logical to expect that Congress will hold some public hearings and hold testimony to try and understand the issue better before they take action on it. In today's environment in Washington, D.C., and the current administration's perspective, if you will, on regulatory burden on industry, it's really questionable how, if at all, any form of regulation could be introduced or oversight could be introduced on the independent device industry. So we're really sort of in this pregnant pause period until the middle of the year, at which point there'll probably be a frenzy of activity and then probably another big pregnant pause to figure out whether the current administration has, you know, any interest whatsoever in this topic. That's the current state of the legislative and sort of regulatory world.
So, David, real quick, for those who maybe this is the first time they're hearing about this or, you know, they're in the hospital level, you know, they have a lot involved in this. They're paying close attention. Is there a way for people to get involved and kind of learn more about the issues?
The Trade Association website, amdso.org, there's information that you can find there that talks about the issue, talks about the pros, talks about the cons, and tries to provide sort of a balanced perspective on the issue. In addition to that, in the very, very near future, you will also find on that page basically a sign-up statement where healthcare professionals, whether they be sterile processing professionals, supply chain professionals, clinical engineering professionals, hospital executives, where basically we kind of created almost a bit of a petition that says, hey, listen, if you believe in the following things, then put your name here and say that you're a part of this movement, because we really think it's important that we preserve the right for hospitals to be able to choose how they have those repairs and how they have that maintenance performed to help not just achieve better patient outcomes, but also to achieve good financial outcomes in an increasingly difficult financial environment for healthcare.
Yeah, I don't think you can stress enough how important it is. I mean, you have hospitals that are having tightening budgets. They're all looking for different ways to be more profitable, be more fiscally sound. And then you're in a situation where you're trying to take away one of the biggest cost savings opportunities that are out there. It would definitely be an enormous financial burden on a hospital. And I think that the work that AMDSO is doing is extremely, extremely important, obviously. And I really appreciate you coming on and talking about maybe what is very little known in the industry. I'm glad we put the website out there. We'll post it for all of our listeners to be able to click and go there in the write-up for the show, David. So thanks for giving us a little bit of insight into what's going on in the industry today.
You bet. My pleasure.
That was David Anbari, Chief Executive Officer at Mobile Instrument Service and Repair, Inc. Hank and Mike, this, you know, is very close to my heart, and I think the right to repair debate is one that absolutely has been kind of sitting out there for a long time. A lot of people have had that debate in the industry over and over and over. It's interesting, especially to hear what's going on relative to the legislative and regulatory efforts, for sure.
Yeah, it's always really interesting when there's something going on at sort of that high political level, but you know that every single sterile processing manager is dealing with this exact question, you know, on a pretty much daily basis.
Just laying the foundation for what the third-party industry looks like, I think David gave us a great insight into that. And as the quote that I read from the news article, you know, I think there's a lot of confusion out there on the part of the public who these guys are that call themselves third-party instrument guys. I thought he did a great job giving us the background story to that, but then also outlining some of those challenges in the industry today, not even on the right to repair side of things, but just the changing landscape of healthcare and how they're confronting that as an industry.
All right, well, that's going to do it for this week's show. As a reminder, you can help support us by subscribing to Beyond Clean on iTunes and Stitcher. We'd certainly appreciate a rating and a review because your feedback is important to the show. And if you have any topics that you would like us to cover on a future episode, or if you would like to share a picture anonymously on our Instagram page, just send an email to info@beyondclean.net. On behalf of Hank, Mike, and myself, thank you for listening to another edition of Beyond Clean.